and it changes. And I'm not talking about restaurants and things like that.
No.
Do you see permanent changes in how people view things, or do you think we'll just within a year drift back to whatever fatal trip we were on?
Power loves a pandemic. I mean, that's the first thing to say. I'm very, you know, incredibly grateful, as of course you are, that Biden's coming to power now, and Trump won't get a second term to exploit what's happening in your country. Two things. One, I think that certainly in Britain there has been this recognition of what nature does for us and to us at times of need. Just this huge outpouring of kind of love and need for nature, particularly during the first lockdown, during what was an incredibly warm and birdsong filled spring here. So I hope that nearby nature will gain a boost. People will care more about getting to green places close to their homes. And the second thing is cities. I really think cities, global cities, are starting to rethink ways in which they can reshape themselves. You know, we've seen Madrid, Barcelona, lots of parts of London, cycleways extended across Europe. At least cities are really, really starting to realize air pollution kills more people than COVID every year. Green cities, walking cities are good cities, and I hope that change will be a positive legacy of Corona.
You've been listening to an interview with Robert McFarlane, whose latest book, which is a collaboration with Stanley Donwood and Dan Richards, is called Ghostways: Two Journeys in Unquiet Places. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves. Bookwaves is produced by Richard Walensky in the studios of KPFA Pacifica Radio in Berkeley, California.
Happy holidays, KBOO listeners. This is SW Conser, host of Words and Pictures. I hope you'll join me next Thursday, December 31st at 11:30 a.m., when I'll be talking with the filmmakers behind the hit documentary, Feels Good, Man. For now, please enjoy this special holiday programming on your radio zine.
The following program is a special encore rebroadcast for these unique pandemic times. Dates, times and events mentioned in the following program have already occurred and are no longer relevant.
Welcome to an encore episode of Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm S.W. Conser. This week, Bill Dodge and I will take you back to December of 2009, when we were visited at the KBOO studios by animation director Daryl Van Sitters, author of the book Mr. Magoo's Christmas Carol, The Making of the First Animated Christmas Special. We are also joined by longtime animator Jack Heider, who was one of the artists at the groundbreaking and often radical UPA Studios back in the early 1960s, and who has fond memories of working on the Magoo Christmas special. A note to our listeners, 1 year after our conversation, a DVD of the Magoo Christmas special was finally released, and in October of 2020, Daryl published a new paperback edition of his book featuring newly added archival material. And now, Daryl Van Sitters and Jack Heider, recorded in Portland, December 2009. And
good morning and welcome to a special holiday edition of Words and Pictures. And we're celebrating Mr. Magoo's Christmas Carol here with Daryl Van Sitters. Just wrote a superb book about it, and I'm here with S.W. Conser.
Hello, yes, and a bit of disclosure. Mr. Van Sitters once wrote my paychecks when I worked at Renegade Animation, but I had nothing to do with bringing him here. That was our friend Jack Heider. But he is touring behind his book, Mr. Magoo's Christmas Carol, The Making of the First Animated Christmas Special.
And also, as mentioned, we have Jack Heider here, who did work on this a superb landmark in American animation as a background artist. Welcome to you both, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you.
So, Daryl, one of the first things we want to ask you is, you worked at all the big studios in the animation industry. You worked at Warner's, you worked at Disney, and you broke away at some point to form your own studio, Renegade Animation. And I was wondering what kind of influence the UPA studios, which created Mr. Magoo, had on you with sort of going independent, going rogue, as you might say.
Yes. I've been in business. I'd worked at the big studios, and I had my fill of the corporate world, and I decided that maybe it was time to step out on my own. So I did that 17 and a half years ago, and we've been going strong ever since then. In terms of the UPA and the design sensibility, I've always had a strong leaning towards design and animation, whether it was TV cartoons or UPA. That was always a strong influence in what we did and how we did it. I preferred that over a more naturalistic approach, and consequently that interest led me to write this book on Mr. Magoo's Christmas Carol.
Well, I think most people would know the UPA studio from Mr. Magoo, but why don't you and Jack give us some background on how UPA came about, what they meant in terms of the animation industry and the artistic end of the industry, as well as the business end.
Sure. UPA was formed a number of years after a huge strike at the Walt Disney Studio. It took about 7 years for it to fully form as UPA, United Productions of America. And it was formed by a lot of malcontents who felt that the process and the kind of art that Disney was doing was a little restrictive, and they wanted to do animation that was more more connected to art, particularly modern art at the time, and felt that they might be able to do that under their own studio. They especially did not want to do talking animal cartoons. They really wanted to do cartoons that focused on art, and when they did do characters, it would be a human character. In fact, the first one that they created that had any legs, so to speak, was Mr. Magoo. Unfortunately for the art side of things, Mr. Magoo came to dominate a lot of their output there, and they ended up doing a lot more Mr. Magoo cartoons than I think they ever had anticipated.
Well, I joined the UPA at the beginning of the McBoing Boing show, and my first job was to do titles and redo titles for the older shorts that had been shown on the big screen. So I had to redesign them to fit on television. At that time, television was
brand new.
And black and white was dominant, but we had to work in color because we didn't want to lose the imagery that we were developing. So that's how I got my start, right after art school. One of the things that I remember so much was that it was an incredible creative influence, and the people that worked there were magnificent. They were just everybody was busy creating within their own areas. And one of the things that impressed me more than anything at that time, because I was new, was the fact that I was accepted right away. I wasn't the low man on the totem pole. I was part of the unit, the whole group. Like, we were all one family, and they even though I didn't have animation experience coming right out of art school, they would even ask my opinion when we looked at dailies and things like that. So it was a great start for me, and working on the Magoo's Christmas Carol was just one of the most exciting things that I had done, and working with so many different talented people.
Well, Jack, I think not everybody would realize that an animated special is done by dozens, maybe hundreds of people. How is it that it just ends up looking like one person did the whole thing when a crew of many, many folks participated in so many ways?
Yeah, that's a phenomenal to me, that the product itself, you know, the finished film, looked like it was done by, you know, one person, and we were so in tune with each other, and we were also in tune with the style, and right from the very beginning, storyboards, the storyboard artists, the directors, the animators, the designers, the painters, it was so cohesive. And like I said, we were like a big family. So when Daryl called me at the beginning of his book, when he started working on his book, I had to go back in time and recall a lot of the things that I had done. I couldn't remember exactly because, in a sense, our work was so similar to, you know, we could tell a little bit about each other's style, but some of we couldn't tell. It was like I had a hard time, you know, remembering my own, you know, my own work because of that, that cohesiveness and the, you know, tightness of our family.
That's the mark of a good animator, isn't it? That you can adapt to so many different styles, to so many different genres, to so many different formats. And in the UPA environment, it wasn't, like you said, a dictatorial top-down management. It was everybody coming together because they had a common purpose.
Exactly. And I think part of that is, I mean, for animators to be able to adapt any style, it's kind of like a session musician. You just you know your craft so well, you can step into it and you can do anything that's handed to you. I kind of lost my train of thought there.
Well, let's talk about how Magoo came about, because obviously Mr. Magoo was a popular character in a studio that didn't necessarily want popular characters, but just because of the restrictions of the marketplace, he became a repeating character so that the studio could continue to exist and continue to turn out material.
That's true, and unfortunately, it wasn't even enough to keep the studio from hitting the shoals of finances. Stephen Bisesta, who was the studio chief, ended up having to sell the company to Henry G. Saperstein, whom a lot of people feel was the death of the UPA studio. Unfortunately, it was not anywhere near as artistically experimental after that, but there still was a lot of amazing, really good art done after he purchased the studio. Saperstein was a licensing and marketing whiz, and he bought the studio strictly because he saw the potential of Mr. Magoo as a licensing, as a huge licensing star. And in fact, he was a great salesman. He was able to turn Mr. Magoo into a huge licensing star for him, and allowed the UPA studio to exist for about another 5 years before it did finally cease production.
One of the things that I think was really one of the best things that Hank Saperstein did was to hire Lior Gill as the head of the
program development.
Yeah, yeah. And because of Lee, we had I have to say we, because I spent a lot of time at UPA, and but we had an opportunity to make a feature film, Gay Paris, and then trailing right behind that was Mr. Magoo's Christmas Carol.
Yes, Lior Gill is kind of the father of the animated holiday special. It was his idea to create the Mr. Magoo's Christmas Carol and get it on the television, and it was the first of its kind.
Let's talk a little bit about the voice talent. Paul Frees, of course, stands out. This is probably the third or fourth time we've talked about Paul Frees and the UPA influence. I know he was one of the voice stars in Gay Paris, and you were saying how many roles did he play in the
Magoo's Christmas Carol? At least four, maybe four. Five.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he's a lot of people know him as Boris Badenoff on Rocky and Bullwinkle,
right.
And know him as Inspector Fenwick, Ludwig von Drake. He was very well known in those days.
Well, maybe that would be a good way to intro this clip we have. Jim Backus as Scrooge talking to Paul Frees, and who else is in that scene? We have...
Those are just the two.
Oh, okay. I thought Maury Amsterdam was in there, too. But let's listen to that for a second.
Merry Christmas!
Merry Christmas!
$3,500. Excellent, excellent. Only thing to be said for the season. People feel obligated to pay their debts. Wouldn't old Jacob Marley have been proud? $3,512. Money piling up. I love it.
Scrooge and Marley's, I believe. Have I the pleasure of addressing Mr. Scrooge or Mr. Marley?
Mr. Marley has been dead these 7 years.
We have no doubt his liberality is well represented by his surviving partner. At this festive season of the year, Mr. Scrooge, 'tis more than usually desirable we should make some slight provisions for the poor and destitute. Hundreds of thousands are in want of common comfort, sir.
Are there no prisons?
Plenty of prisons.
And the workhouses, are they still in operation?
They are. Still, I wish I could say they were not. What shall we put you down for?
Nothing.
You wish to remain anonymous?
I wish to be left alone. I support the establishments I have mentioned. They cost enough, and those who are badly off. He must go there.
Many can't go there, and many would rather die.
If they would rather die, they had better do it and decrease the surplus population. Now I'm very busy, gentlemen. I bid you good afternoon. Be gone! Out!
You know, I keep wondering, nowadays, what would the bankers and the industrialists be carrying around behind them on their chains? You know, Marley was carrying around lock boxes and such.
And accounting books.
And it just seems very familiar. And obviously, at the time, UPA and the folks involved were paying attention to the political and social atmosphere around them and were updating this classic Christmas Carol story.
All right, correct.
I had a thought, too, because of the clip that was, it sounded like Magoo was a grouchy old man, but I wanted to indicate that the story, the Christmas Carol, was wrapped around the idea that Magoo was an actor, a Broadway star, and that was kind of the one of his acting roles, because Mr. Magoo was very lovable, yeah. And all of his gags were based on the fact that he was confused by his nearsightedness. But in this, he plays a full role. At the intro and the finale of the show, of the Mr. Magoo's Christmas Carol, we see him as a Broadway star, but it's the lovable Mr. Magoo going into his typical nearsighted gags, you know.
Yes, indeed. This is actually the first animated special that made it to TV. We're talking again about Mr. Magoo's Christmas Carol, the book, which is put out by Daryl Fan Sitters. And you're telling about Mr. Magoo as a character. Originally started out as a grouchy character. Some people say he was supposed to be a very reactionary character, but he developed into a very lovable, nearsighted character. So it became an issue to turn him into Scrooge, and this was done by turning him into a Broadway actor playing the role of Scrooge.
Exactly. The concern was that he had been like this grouchy old man, and then he became more like a bumbling grandfather type. And so they wanted to make sure that people understood that he was playing a role, that this wasn't who Mr. Magoo had suddenly become. And I think it worked very, very well. I think it was one of a very smart move on Leora Gell's part.
And in fact, tell us how successful the show was when it premiered.
The show was a huge hit. It was a big hit for the sponsor Timex. It was a big hit for NBC. The show was up against, at the time there were only three networks, which seems strange nowadays. It was up against two action shows, and it beat them, both of the shows handily. It garnered a 39 share, which if anybody is hip to television ratings, nothing gets that kind of a rating anymore. It was even more successful the second year. In fact, it was so successful, NBC and Timex held on to it for 5 years. And gradually it went into syndication and became less and less popular with less exposure.
And we have to make sure to give credit to the great songs from this special that are just perennials.
Yes, it was a team of Julie Stein and Bob Merrill who were about to gain fame as the songwriters for Funny Girl, starring Barbara Streisand.
Right. Kind of a lull in the production, right?
Yeah, Funny Girl was a tempestuous production, and they had reached a kind of an impasse at that point. So when Leora Gell contacted them, they had the time and the inclination to do the score. It's a Broadway-worthy score. It's an amazing, amazing song score.
Well, given that cue, let's get Emily to go to track 6, which is one of my favorites.
And we'll remind you that you're listening to Words and Pictures. And our guests today are Daryl Fan Sitters, author and publisher of the book Mr. Magoo's Christmas Carol, The Making of the First Animated Christmas Special. And we also have Jack Heider in the studio, who was one of the colorist background people and all-around artistic talents on the production, which premiered in 1962.
Hurry, children, our dinner is ready.
Will we have a gander and some razzleberry dressing?
Oh, razzleberry dressing would be nice. may be Razzleberry dressing twice.
We haven't had a hen since I can tell you when. We love a hen again
with Razzleberry dressing.
And the show again is Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. We're here with Bill Dodge, and we're talking about Mr. Magoo's Christmas Carol, the making of the first Christmas special. This was not a sure hit, but it turned out a couple years later, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer came out, and Charlie Brown Christmas special, and after that, the floodgates were open.
Exactly. It was groundbreaking. In fact, you can even see that there's a lot of parallels with the second Christmas special, which was the Rankin Bass Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. It's an hour-long special, just like Mr. Magoo was, using a well-known songwriter, in that case Johnny Marks, who had written Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. It was a musical, animated. Clearly, they had seen the template, and they knew it worked. And whether or not it was a direct influence in terms of all of those things I just mentioned is unknown. But clearly, it has established the ground rules for doing an animated Christmas special.
And you, by the way, I want to mention, Daryl Fensitters, you have published this book yourself. You've obviously overseen the coloring of it, because color in this case, anybody who's watched these shows, especially the UPA films, knows that there's so much focus on the color, the styling, the line, all of these elements. So this book itself has it has lost production sketches. It has photographs that you've dug up. And this is something that people will probably not find in bookstores, but it's been a labor of love. And anybody who's really interested in the history of animation, the social aspect of animation in Christmas and holidays in general, might be interested in how to get a hold of a copy of the book.
Yes, you can get it at Mr. Magoo's ChristmasCarol.com. I personalize copies for people who get it. It is it does have a lot of stuff that you won't find, that you would never have seen anywhere else. The artwork was particularly important, and I wanted to make sure that the color was accurate in this thing, because you don't see, even in the DVD, you don't see as nice a color as the actual artwork is. And we found rare recording session photos. It was amazing what I was able to dig up when we started digging. And yes, I did have to do it on my own, because I could not find a publisher who felt it was a story worth telling. I however, differed.
I was extremely impressed with the book, yeah. Mainly because of the work that Daryl went through to dig up all this material. But also, not only that, it was like going back in time for me and visiting my old friends that I'd worked with and seeing their work. And but also, the book enlightened me quite a bit in as much as how the film had got off the ground. Because at that time, I was busy working on another show, and then all of a sudden I was called in and kind of do this. And I said, sure, I'd be glad to work on it. I didn't know anything about all of the things that had gone ahead. And we just had a production to do. And I think that Lee Orgel took an incredible, giant step by, starting this project in the first place.
Jack, you were saying that you took a lot of your work home, too. It was, right? It was something that you guys really believed in and didn't mind putting in a little extra time.
Well, we were used to working without a time clock.
Yeah.
Yeah. And once they put the time clock on us, we would have to stop for breaks and stop for lunch and go home at quitting time. So at quitting time, we would just bundle up our work and take it home and do some of the paintings and, do our whatever. All the animators, everybody went home and did it. But the actual production was about 4 months, isn't that correct?
5 months, yeah.
5 months.
That's amazing. Start to finish, an hour's worth of animation in 5 months. But it actually took, about a year's worth of getting approvals from various people. And at the time, I guess you had to get a sponsor. And during this time, the director was still finishing up the feature film, the theatrical feature film, Gay Paris. So he was doing double duty, Abe Levitow.
Right. And same with Lee Orgel. He had to keep his feet in both camps there and make sure that neither one of them slowed down or missed their deadlines or budget. It was kind of an incredible job, and all of the efforts, I mean, the main effort was put on the feature, and this was kind of the stepchild, and Mr. Magoo's Christmas Carol ended up being the one that everyone remembers.
Yeah, Gay Paris kind of fell by the wayside. As a young child, I was a fan of the Aristocats, which was the Disney feature, which seemed to mirror Gay Paris, almost character for character, and Gay Paris still hasn't really had the revival that it deserves, even in this age when the lyricist Yip Harburg is being celebrated anew for some of not just his political opinions, but also his musical talents.
Right.
One of the things that a lot of people overlook about Gay Paris was the artwork. The art director, Victor Habush, on that show had decided that they would use their own impression of the Impressionist artwork. So it wasn't that they were duplicating the artwork from the Impressionist, but they were using the styles to enrich the show.
In fact, a number of the sequences are painted in different Impressionist styles.
Right, right.
And one thing that I think you both have been fascinated with is you're both still active in animation. Jack, you're forming up your own company. But the UPA style, which seemed to go dormant, that seemed to be forgotten for a while, has had renewed interest in the digital age.
Absolutely. I think that design sense actually lends itself well to the digital age with the limitations and with the just the design sensibility that people have right now.
Yeah, and it's people like Daryl who actually hold on to that design work and enhances it and uses it to his works.
Absolutely. Everybody in animation has been strongly influenced by that studio. And it was a big influence at the time, too. You'll notice that the Warner Brothers cartoons suddenly started getting more designy in their backgrounds, too, back in the 50s. It influenced every studio.
Yeah.
So when are we going to see the Mr. Magoo Christmas special on TV every year the way we see all the others? Now, what happened to that?
It kind of fell into a bad times when it went into syndication, and gradually people just forgot about it. And now the owners of the special are trying to get it on there. In fact, they've said that we can't even give it away. They're working very hard to get it on television next year, and they've told me that they're also working to get a Blu-ray DVD with bonus features out, with the film in high definition. It's much, much prettier than it ever has been.
And in fact, one of the reasons that it kind of fell by the wayside is because it used to get cut up to fit in more commercials.
Yes, it was a 52-minute special, and they would cut it down to fit it within a half an hour. And that when they went that extreme, they actually cut out most of the songs, which makes it a very dull story. They actually cut out some of the storytelling songs like Back on Broadway or Winter Was Warm when they did it for syndication.
Now, on your site, Mr. Magoo's ChristmasCarol.com, are you going to have news about not only the book, but also the possibility of a DVD and all the other release notes and things?
Absolutely. Initially, we've just been putting that in the comments section. So if you go to the comments section, you'll find out the most up-to-date information about what's happening with Mr. Magoo's Christmas Carol, but there will be devoted pages to it, too.
Well, it's been a pleasure to have you in the studio. We know you have a plane to catch, Daryl Fansitters, but thanks for coming by with your book, Mr. Magoo's Christmas Carol, The Making of the First Animated Christmas Special.
Thank you. It's been great to be here.
And it's always great to have Jack hiding in the studio.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you very much.
And I think we have another cut to go out on from the Mr. Magoo Christmas Special.
Fezziwig's Dance.
You've been listening to an encore episode of Words and Pictures, recorded in December of 2009, and featuring one-time UPA animator Jack Heider, along with animation director Daryl Fansitters, author of the book Mr. Magoo's Christmas Carol, The Making of the First Animated Christmas Special. I'm S.W. Conser, joined by Bill Dodge. A note to our listeners, 1 year after this conversation was recorded, a DVD of the Magoo Christmas Special was finally released. And in October of 2020, Daryl published a new paperback edition of his book, featuring newly added archival material. Before we go, I'd like to remind you that your community radio needs your support during this time of social distancing. To become a member of KBOO or to arrange for a donation of any size, you can visit kboo.fm. or giveguide.org. Every dollar donated through GiveGuide this holiday season will be matched one-to-one, up to $25,000.
Ah, thank you! Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, what a marvelous ovation.
Turn around!
Our director. And let's hear it for our director. Ladies and gentlemen, our director.
Oh, no.
How will you listen to that applause? I'm a goo, and you've done it again. And by George, I'm brought down the house. Ah, thank you. Hey, Merry Christmas, everyone.
Portland, listener-supported community radio. Stay tuned for Shocks of Sheba, up next after these headlines.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM.